You are listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture. This is issue number 8, talking about my generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. I'm Tim Cox, the guest editor and narrator for the issue. This is episode number 10, Academia. In this episode, and the following on practice, the specifically American context of this generation becomes a running theme. American architectural academia, and this generation of architects, is organized around a series of top-rated schools who have concentrated funding in order to build competitive programs and be single-digit selective of students and faculty. The architecture programs at these schools have benefited from the centralization of resources and have used them to carve out spaces of experimentation which are independent from the demands of the profession. However, this cohort wasn't always satisfied with the distance between academia and practice and felt that their ties to academia could be limiting. Kyle Miller touches on many of the themes of this episode while reflecting on the specificity of American architectural academia.
Most other places, to my knowledge, don't have the luxurious academic positions that we have access to as designers, meaning early in our careers, we can acquire a teaching position that affords us time and space to work independently with resources, financial and student labor at times, with stability and without oversight. And what that comes at the expense of is doing the work in a material way that engages with the, you know, the realities of the built environment.
As Miller highlights, the academy is a space of extraordinary freedom for those who can secure stable positions. Many members of this generation shared this opinion and saw value in the isolation of academia from the demands of the market. The argument continues that the university is a creative and intellectual refuge from the profit-motivated world of practice. They stressed that this distance from practice was also important for students, as a time to think about architectural questions outside of a client-service provider relationship. Kyle Schumann, Meredith Miller, McLean Clutter, and Katie McDonald all discussed academia as a key site of architectural knowledge transfer that is not oriented towards maximizing profits.
Being within the academic system, I'm a huge fan of many of the things that it affords, such as this place where free thought can be fostered maybe in some ways that maybe it can't be in other ways. But I also think that certain disciplinary ideas within architecture can kind of be tested and worked through and talked about and critiqued within academia in ways that can't necessarily happen within the real world being architectural practice, because the concerns are totally different. You're serving a client, it's a service-oriented profession, you need to pay your employees, right? It's tied into this whole sort of economic system. And so I think that teaching students conceptual frameworks and fundamental disciplinary ideas about the roles that architecture can have or ways that you can work through architectural ideas, I think that some of those conceptual frameworks are like way more foundational and critical to teach within schools. I mean, I'm always interested in teaching my students to be thought leaders and look at how they can apply their skills and new ways of thinking through these architectural frameworks in a variety of ways, whether they choose to be architects or not after they graduate, right? I'm way more interested in that than in training students to go be a CAD monkey in a firm, right? And doing Revit wall sections or whatever.
I also think that there's a value in an architecture education that doesn't have to lead to profession or the practice.
In part, our job is to educate students in all of the aspects of architecture that no client is ever going to pay them to learn on the job. And I believe in all of those aspects of architecture. I think that they are toothless if we set them up as antagonistic to the realities of the political economy that these students will be operating in. I hope that it's a kind of enduring reminder of the capacities of these aspects of architecture that can't be quantified, that clients might not know that they're paying for.
I would say the types of discussions that happen at these schools is incredibly important, formative for students, and foundational in establishing our discipline as something that is not only about the economic production of space, but space as a larger project. There are already other disciplines, or maybe not so much disciplines, but there are already other economic actors like developers who've taken on the creation of space and limited the market share of space, which is actually designed by architects. And the proper disciplinary expertise will win out over the developer-designed project every time, which is just a way of saying that I think that we have incredibly important expertise, that it's refined and expanded in such discussions, and that I wish it could reach further and impact more schools.
Respondents frequently felt that the potential to experiment in practice was incredibly limited, and they saw academia as the place for work that was trying to push boundaries. This freedom to ask questions and test ideas is a key reason why this generation chose to pursue academic careers in the first place. Here's Eric Herman, Stuart Hicks, Michael Young, Bryony Roberts, and Brittany Udding on the ability to experiment in academia.
Academia does need to be a space of exception. It does need to be a place where you can have time and space to work on new ideas. We're a little pessimistic maybe about those opportunities in practice, and so I would hope that those things can happen more in academic settings where at least there's not the most resources, but at least some stability and some resources.
The academic architecture project needs to be isolated from the commercialization of it to be able to operate. There needs to be a sense of experimentation that is freed from applicability all the time to be able to try things. At certain periods in time, maybe, the academic project is more wrapped up in practice. There are ebbs and flows. Personally, I'm trying to march them toward one another a little bit.
I understand the position of a European architect who can be dismissive of the overly theoretical, discursive ways in which architecture on the East Coast or American academic architecture can disassociate itself from the realities of practice. But at the same time, not to like sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I think some of the most important, most interesting questions are being asked in the academy. And those questions require time and they require discourse and they require distance.
Architecture schools in the US are places where you can really cultivate critical thinking about the field. There's a freedom in that. It's a place where you don't only have to train to perform as a professional, but you can really question the fundamental principles of the discipline. That's the goal, anyway.
For us, we left practice to join academia because it felt like a way that we could form a design and research collaborative that wasn't beholden to loft renovations and villas, but could actually think through the project of architecture of the city without having to so intimately interface with the realities of construction. I look at it not as a retreat, but as a desire to work through different mediums and different formats.
We will keep this ambition of intellectual freedom and architectural exploration in mind throughout the rest of this episode, where we will turn towards the realities of working in academic institutions and their disciplinary shortcomings. Some respondents felt that despite the promise of intellectual freedom, pedagogy was increasingly homogeneous and inoffensive. Michael Meredith and Paul Preisner both reflected on the lack of position taking at schools in the current moment.
A lot of schools are more nervous about the idea of putting out a canon or even precedents for students. it either has to be so broad, you give them like an encyclopedic set that is like a la carte pedagogy and people can pick what they want from it, or nothing almost, you know, and you stick with ideas or concepts in very broad terms. There's very little that institutions want to put on the table as to what architecture is.
When I was in school, it seemed much clearer that there were schools of architecture, and those were different depending on the institution and the country that that institution took place. And I don't think those differences exist so much anymore. I think schools are all largely the same, and that feels different than how it was when I was a student, and there were much clearer ideological projects going on in institutions, and certainly technological ones and the resultant formal ones. That doesn't seem to be the case today.
The refuge provided by academia was also problematized by rising tuition costs and the increasingly pragmatic needs of students. Which is to say, one way that the structures of academia shape this generation is through the students they teach. The intellectual space that academics describe as liberating them from the concerns of the market often doesn't apply to the students in these programs, who are saddled with debt and are looking for marketable skills that they can use to establish their career outside of the world of academia. With financial pressure for return on investment, there was less interest in disciplinary concerns, like history and theory. Disciplinarity was increasingly not of use to students. Here's David Eskenazi, Curtis Roth, and Christy Ballier.
Being a student or being in an academy was a space to be removed from society or from certain pressures in society. And I love that as its ambition, but I don't think that that's the reality that school has been, at least for the last 20 years. We all know that there's an insane financial realism to how life is right now. And I think that the sense that all of our contributions, intellectual contributions, can be totally separate from that is never really fit into, let's say, the space that we exist in. And so I don't know exactly when that break occurs, whether it's like a millennial break, or I see it now with the even younger people, it's like more of a serious issue.
Basically, all of the students who come out of my thesis program are going to go into an office in Columbus or maybe Chicago, but they're basically going to go into a regional office. And that was absolutely not the case for like my cohort at MIT, where most folks didn't come out of school and immediately go into an office. People went into all kinds of weird stuff, including teaching. And so one of the things that I wrestle with a lot is, what is the value of this conversation for someone who's gonna like go out and make buildings in Columbus, Ohio? Is this a relevant conversation to that person? Can I really ask someone to pay $50,000 or $30,000 or whatever to go to school here and talk about Deleuze so that they can then go out and not that, I think the tricky thing is like, you want to do that, obviously respecting everyone's intelligence and respecting the value of all kinds of work, both like abstract work and really practical work. But I think it, in places maybe like OSU, it requires a real focusing of the relationship maybe between the more abstract or theoretical dimensions of architecture and how that impacts the lives of those students who are going to make a living doing buildings in Columbus, Ohio, right? That's structured a lot of the teaching that I do here, and a lot of the ways that we organize the thesis program here has to do with the fact that all of our students are here to become practicing architects, not to do what I did, which is to move to another city and teach architecture.
We recently gave a lecture, and like a comment at the end was, well, this lecture was very academic. I felt, wow, the invitation was from an academic institution to a group of students pursuing academics. You know, it is quite interesting, this, you know, this concern over work that is participating in a conversation with the discipline, as if it does that, it doesn't have escape velocity towards practice.
Even in their careers as academic architects deeply informed by the discipline, some felt that architectural education was too dislocated from practice. In an ongoing debate over if architectural pedagogy should focus on ideas or directly applicable skills, Joffre Kolb, Mira Henry, and Michael Meredith all argued for orienting pedagogy towards the needs of practice.
I have a huge problem with the way that we teach architecture. And as someone who teaches core level studios at some of these universities, like this semester, I'm teaching Core 1 at Yale and Core at Columbia. I've taught at almost every school in the Northeast at this point. I know what the problems are, and I don't think that we're preparing students to be great architects or to even be great workers. You know, like our employees who come through, it's just like it takes so much to try and prepare them to do like a meeting for a client as opposed to some overly critical disciplinary. You ask someone to make a drawing and they don't try and make a drawing that you can show in front of someone. They try and make a drawing that's built off of 40 years of a history of architectural representation that no one could possibly understand except an academic.
Even those who are in academics are thinking about academics and less like highly theoretically and more boots on the ground architecture, as much as one can manage that in an academic context.
I was trying to make the case yesterday with Sylvia and Liz in their class that we need at this moment to have a kind of renewed realism, a renewed attachment to realism. I mean, pedagogically, why do we start with words and diagrams and concepts first on things as opposed to construction or buildings or these other things that are probably more expert? When I've ever been hired by somebody, I mean, rarely do they say something like, tell me all your ideas and your concepts. They want to know, you know, how is it going to work? We have in schools through the American model have made it an active effort to say that we are not a service profession, that we're not a technical schools. I mean, I've sat through many faculty meetings where people get upset saying we don't teach skills, we teach concepts. Can we change that model at all? Just, is it like you said, we're providing cultural expertise, the latest cool thing to people? Are we providing more meaning in their lives? What are we providing? I mean, I'm open to anything, but it should be debated what it is that we think we do. And the reality is probably a combo of all these things.
Meredith continues and reflects on the way Princeton historically emphasized construction details.
Postmodernism did a lot of damage to architecture, where you do need the idea of the project or the text or the concept to support the building. And Princeton wasn't like that before postmodernism. Because I've looked into these institutional histories a little bit. People graduated in the 40s. I looked at all the syllabi that they were being taught. It was radically different. Even the syllabi at Princeton in the 60s and 70s, and every project required that students drew a full-scale wall section. I couldn't imagine that nowadays.
One way this manifests is in the increased interest in professional practice courses, which are typically regarded as simple boxes to check for a school's accreditation. From anecdotes we've heard previously about using these courses to teach students about unionization efforts in the field, to publish books like Kyle Miller and Molly Hunker's Building Practice, these courses are being taken seriously by this generation. The renewed attention to these elements of practice also speaks to students' desire to understand the field they will be entering, and not just the discursive history of the discipline. Here's Niran Taran and Meredith Miller.
This new generation rethinks when somebody builds something, goes out there and comes to a professional practice course and tells us what happened. And that knowledge gets, again, back to academia, to students. You see what I'm trying to say? So it's not just this, okay, the object or the building, and then we keep talking about just relationship between the representation and the building. It's also like the actual work that happens. From the permit to code to this to that.
I taught professional practice for the first time. I co-taught it with Irene Huang, who has developed this amazing course over the past few years. And, you know, it's informed by some of the work of Peggy Diemer and the architecture lobby and arguing for the value of the architecture worker in a way, just to sort of give students a window into what they can expect when they enter the workforce. But it's also thinking more broadly about the role of practice in society and it's a great course, but I feel like it's an inconclusive one, and the students come out of it having read a variety of perspectives and maybe feeling a little bit anxious. But the idea is to help show them that there's a kind of diversity of possible trajectories for them, and to just be realistic about what they can kind of expect as they are shaping their own career decisions.
Alongside the pedagogical concerns that have been brought forward by students amid the ever-rising cost of higher education, academic institutions also expect certain kinds of production from their faculty. The academy is a workplace where this generation both teaches and generates design and writing. So the structures and incentives of these institutions have an impact on the architectural culture that this cohort produces. Paul Preisner discusses the relationship between academic labor, architectural production, the needs of students, and the precarity at the nexus of these elements. While academia may be a refuge and a place that's open to experimentation, those experiments are expected to be successful. Here's Preisner.
I had the privilege and pleasure to be a part of a group of people who started the unionization campaign at UIC a long time ago and was part of the union as a kind of representative from our college and then as vice president of the union. And we're a unionized faculty, and I think we have securities and comforts for tenure and tenure track and non-tenure track faculty that most schools don't have at all. But it's still not so great for people who aren't on the tenure track. And us, like other institutions, when a tenured faculty retires or a tenure track faculty leaves, you don't tend to get those lines back to give to a new one. You just get a new adjunct contract allowed, right? Or a new clinical contract allowed, which is to say you end up with a more precarious form of labor teaching. In some ways, the result of that is you have an increasing amount of the intellectual research done at a school and the kind of teaching research done at a school by people who, whether they're aware of it or not, are terrified of where they're going to teach the next semester and then the next semester after that. And as a result, you end up producing work or exploring parts of the field that are insanely topical and trendy because you don't have the luxury of trying something out that could be a disaster, because then you're done, right? If you do a studio that ends up being terrible, there aren't many schools that have the patience to keep you around because you tried something experimental and it was a flop. And these are really complicated things because it's not like it's just the person at the school. It's also the students and what they demand of an education, where they don't want to be part of a true experiment, because true experiments can go really badly. Like, even if they end up being cognitively formative and very helpful for your education and the work, you feel like you lost out on something, because then you have a bad portfolio, for example, right? And so you're not going to get into the grad school you want or work at the office you want. And it's a really depressing and gross landscape.
Preisner sums up the stakes for the semester-to-semester task of teaching architecture, but the landscape of hiring new faculty has also shifted. This generation saw an increase in academic specialization as a defining characteristic of their cohort, and something that people understood as a prerequisite to landing an academic job in the current moment. Here's Hans Tersak, and then Eric Herman, on how the conditions of the job market encourage people to specialize.
There's also a hyper-specialization and a pressure within the academy to be hyper-specialized that I feel is very unique to my generation. I often look at instructors of mine who are, you know, mentors and people that I look up to, and I think if they presented their project today in like a job talk or a lecture, it would probably be met with a huge degree of suspicion, because it doesn't adhere to the tenets of research that are like the current standard.
Another thing that's really different is the way that people are recruited into like assistant professorships. In previous generations, maybe some of these calls were a little bit more generic, just like looking for someone to teach architecture. And now they're extremely specific. When you read job postings, they're incredibly narrow in terms of who they're targeting. So, you know, you'll have a search and they'll be looking for someone in digital fabrication. But then on top of that, there's like three more criteria. They always want every person in that system to represent a very specific thing for the school. So you can't have like too many people doing the same type of thing because they want to have a larger reach.
Here, we can see this generation's embrace of aesthetic and ideological pluralism from a different angle, as a byproduct of the incentive structures established by the academic job market that require individuals to present themselves as incredibly specialized. Kyle Schumann, Hans Tersak, and Curtis Roth all discuss the ways that the need for specificity has impacted the output of this generation.
I feel like a shift towards more focused specializations with even academic jobs. Institutions now are looking for people to sort of fill different expertise sets in their curricula, maybe, or in their programs, to the point where a lot of job searches now seem to be very specific in terms of area. Like, we're looking for a person to be an expert in this area, right? And so that has an effect on all these young academics who are like going around to different schools looking for jobs, sort of where are they going to land? Where are they going to situate themselves? There's maybe even more attention than there was previously on how do I develop or demonstrate that sort of expertise.
I will say with the recent crops of fellows, you do see more of a focus and something that is closer to a scientific model where someone's working on, you know, water or oil or whatever, additive manufacturing, something like that. As opposed to someone who's like, I'm interested in, I guess, you know, me, like texture mapping and how it relates to the way that we perceive buildings and also understand the ontological status of form. Maybe that's becoming a little bit less popular. Even experimental academic architecture is sliding more towards a scientific model. And so we are becoming less generalists and more specialists. Or we are generalists who don the disguise of a specialist. And as someone who does quote unquote research more in a scientific model of result publication, and then you move forward with this hyper-focused project to the next stage.
There's a high degree of specificity largely in the practices of my peers. There's a real demand to identify what it is specifically that you're doing and to render yourself distinct from other practices that are contemporary to you. That was always a burden for me in going through this process of applying for fellowships, applying for teaching gigs, and so forth, is to be super, super clear about what I'm doing and how it's different from what other people are doing. If I kind of back up a little bit, I think a lot of times we talk about the questions of generationality in terms of maybe the effects of media, or people talk about it in terms of the attention economy or the effects of social media or whatever. But I think a lot of it also has to do with how people have to make a living. What do you have to do to your work in order to be able to secure a teaching position, to pay off your student loans, to pay your rent, and so forth? And I think that can produce something which looks a lot like indifference in a way, because I don't know if I would say that I'm indifferent to sustainability, for example, but I'm also very clear that that's not what I do. Maybe that specificity, I think, is a kind of mark of the contemporary moment.
We can hear explanations for many aesthetic and ideological trends in the way this generation describes the requirements of their academic careers. The high degree of specificity required by the contemporary job market encourages diverse design output and research focus, and, as Roth just described, produces a level of indifference towards aspects of architecture which are outside of the expertise of each individual. This move towards individual territories of expertise also means shared conversations are more and more difficult to sustain and less useful for any individual practitioner. We might see the group's rejection of camps or shared groups in a similar vein. Emphasizing differences between architects could provide more benefit than participating in a shared project with others. Another factor which this generation described as influencing their output was the requirements and affordances of tenure track. Tenure track provides a specific timeline, which is often unfriendly to investing in a built practice, but it also gives unmatched job security. Here's Eric Herman.
I would start first by saying that we are incredibly privileged in our positions as being both on tenure track at Ohio State. And while there are a lot of stresses to that process, it's given us our longest period of stability for a while. So, you know, we'd become quite accustomed to these kind of year-to-year contracts where we would get fired in June and then, you know, await a decision. But it's a funny thing because it's a 5-year period, essentially, where you're expected to produce, well, it's very ambiguous what you're supposed to be producing, but there's a certain expectation of production, let's say, just some production. 5 years is not very long in architecture and buildings. It's very long in writing and images. And so it's hard to imagine how someone would go through this process and do it based on practice, at least in a traditional sense, a brick and mortar sense. It creates this ecosystem where you're dependent upon your peers for inspiration, but also validation in the field, because you have to have your work, you know, accepted to things, and you have to share the work, and you have to always be producing. So I think that for us to work at that pace, or to be successful in that system, we've tried to frame our design as research, and that can still be difficult. So we're under the authority here of an engineering school. That's where the Knowlton School is positioned. And so, you know, they're used to peer-reviewed papers and reference rankings and all these kind of things that we just don't really have. And you have to kind of explain the difference between something that's peer-reviewed versus something in log. And you have to, like, account for the fact that the difference between a drawing and a built object represents thousands and thousands of hours of time. Now that we're in this system, I'm starting to understand the type of work that everyone is producing. Things just become way more clear. You need this culture and currency of group shows. You need this culture and currency of installations and architecture that can be produced really quickly and then turned into writing. So that ecosystem demands certain tendencies of the speed of working and the type of work. The portrait we have now of the typical quote-unquote assistant professor is, like, kind of inevitable from that.
We heard frequently from this generation that pursuing tenure meant they were disincentivized from pursuing a building practice and were instead pushed towards installations, exhibitions, books, and speculative work. Interviewees felt that the 5 to 7 years typical of a tenure track timeline just wasn't enough time to establish a building practice that would be discursively relevant enough to warrant tenure. Here's Stuart Hicks, Paul Preisner, Neron Turan, Clark Thenhouse, and Meredith Miller.
It would be very hard to build on a tenure track timeline because you'd be really invested in building a building for 3 or 4 years, and you might not have a ton to show for it. The time frames are just really incompatible. And what substitutes is if you win a competition, that's peer review. That's a jury of your peers or above claiming your project's worthy. It's being written about in magazines and that sort of thing. So those metrics lend themselves to proliferating ideas and small-scale things and not really architecture.
You do need content to have your tenure promotion evaluated on, but that doesn't seem wrong. And there isn't the same amount of work going around, and the work that is going around for younger people in the conventional sense of what an architectural project could be won't be interesting enough to warrant tenure in a research institution, because most people will get the chance to do really conventional work because of budget or client or something like that. So to be more creative or whatever, you have to do things like installation work or rendering work or book work or something that isn't really bound by the market in the same way that that actual architecture is.
Architecture is slow and it takes a lot of time. And I think that that sometimes is too slow for the cycle of someone who's, you know, in a tenure track position. That's why installations, exhibitions, and other things are a little bit, let's say, faster, meaning you can see the outcome. You don't have to wait 3 years for the project to finish.
tenure track is really about volume. It's about a volume of work and engagements with various publications and venues and so forth. And practice is slow. Projects take a long time. And so there's a conflict there, right? And the institutions don't generally value the building of a practice as much as they value the research component. And for, you know, makes sense for a lot of reasons. But trying to build a building practice is, those projects are slower. For those on tenure track, it is a volume game in a lot of ways. And so trying to, you know, spending half of your tenure track clock on one house project or something, 2 to 3 years, it's not an equitable or efficient use of that clock that the institution gives you.
There's been more of a professionalization of academic architecture. The churn of academic production, the platforms and opportunities for academic production, I think those have exploded in the past 15 years in terms of exhibitions and publications and symposia and all of these things that are all kind of existing within this somewhat closed world of architecture academia, but that are important to do because they feed into the tenure track production that academic architects are expected to do, but maybe take away from the other possible trajectory, which is trying to establish a building practice. Because if you look at academic architects who maybe got tenure 15 years ago or 20 years ago, it might have been on the basis of a local architecture practice that had done a few projects, had published them, had received AIA awards, and that was their body of work that allowed them to gain tenure. And I don't think you see that these days, that that's not what is supported or celebrated.
As we heard, installations, pavilions, and exhibitions became common work outputs. While we can understand them as typologies that this generation was pushed towards because of their academic jobs, some also saw them as dress rehearsals for practice. They argued that small-scale built work could serve as a stepping stone towards larger commissions. They also saw installations and exhibitions as ways to prototype experimental building systems or materials outside of a model of client patronage. But for others, the pavilion represented a dead end. The skill set required for winning competitions and putting together pavilions doesn't necessarily translate into building practice. Installations don't need to meet building code or get a permit, and are often self-constructed, meaning there's little to no engagement with the contractors and consultants who are key collaborators in practice. Here are Kyle Reynolds, Jerome Hafford, and Kyle Schumann.
The pavilion, or the installation, or the exhibition, that's the thing that academia has created as a way to test out some of these ideas in limited built format.
I think a lot of us are doing experimental installation artworks and hoping to scale that up. And in some cases, slowly we are scaling it up.
The number of installation venues for like young practices is actually diminished. I mean, Ragdale is still around, but MoMA PS1 is discontinued. I don't know if City of Dreams or Figment is still going in New York or not. And so there's also a smaller number of venues for those type of installations. I find the installation, or like the prototype basically, as still being super valuable in proving out or testing some of these ideas, because as soon as you have to build something one-to-one or put it out in the real world, then you have to deal with those social or cultural or programmatic functions of it, right? Or you have to engage with the public and get that public reaction, or you have to do that as a proof of concept for a new material or technology that then gets the interest of journalists and enters into the public discourse. I think there's still a lot of value in physical prototyping and installation scale work as a way of piloting maybe radical ideas in a way that's tangible and therefore enters into the public imagination.
You can win competitions, you can build pavilions, you can do exhibitions and teach and cobble something together that you call a practice and continue operating that way. I don't know if it's unique, but it seems like there's more pavilion projects, there's more exhibitions, there's more competitions that allows for that to happen. when firms get fed up with that process because it's tiring and doesn't pay well and that sort of stuff, they find that they don't know how to build for clients, or they don't know how to get clients, because all the skills that they've built up are about winning competition and like operating in this other world that's a little bit different.
This line of thinking sees this generation as somewhat painted into a corner. After having spent their early career hopping between academic jobs and then working through writing and temporary architecture to secure tenure, they find themselves isolated from the building practice they want to have. To conclude, we will discuss these tensions between academia and practice, and this generation's ambivalence towards both realms. In the next and final thematic episode, we will discuss practice at length. As we've heard, the needs of academia and the needs of practice are at odds with each other, and transition between the two is challenging. Some still saw academia as the most supportive place to do experimental architectural work, and accepted this distance from building practice. Some felt strongly that it was simply not possible to do meaningful work outside of academia, and that this generation had chosen to work in the academy due to a lack of opportunity for meaningful practice in the profession. Here are Mira Henry, Andrew Holder, and John Lott.
The economy of building is so hostile and intense. There's not a lot of space for offices working that aren't, you know, at a corporate level, unless you have a way of supplementing your livelihood. And so there's, you know, teaching performs a very important service in that way of creating a space for creative practitioners.
The conversion of architecture from the status of cultural artifact to financial instrument is very nearly complete. And that conversion has left very little room for architects who want to continue to practice as though they're in service of ideas as much as they are in service to the client who's paying them. So I think it is natural that architects who still see themselves as designing for culture broadly have had to find a home in the academy because no one else is paying the bills on a regular basis. I think it is maybe the last preserve of credibility for being able to stand up and say that my audience is culture broadly, not my audience is not, you know, Jim with the checkbook. I just don't know that there's anywhere else for us to go.
The institution that we call the academy is one of the biggest support structures for the exposure of practitioners who are trying to do something outside of the pressure of a service-driven industry. It offers a little bit more room to practice critically, to think the project is an opportunity to also raise questions about alternatives rather than simply respond with answers. And to just give solutions that are about one thing or taste or money. It allows for commentary. It allows for questions. It also allows room for the project to have discursive value.
The harsh economic realities of practice provided a push towards academia for Meredith Miller and Joffre Kolb.
It's also, you know, generational wealth. Some people come out of graduate school, maybe a couple years of working for someone, and they're able to sustain their own practice through family, you know, connections and sort of funding their own projects. And I think that is true of a lot of successful architecture firms that we see, right? And so there's a kind of economic reality of having the stable income of an academic job, you know, especially at a moment when that's not the case with working in practice.
Our teaching is what supports us to do projects around reuse through like test beds or our work with museums or our work with other things, because those don't pay us money. So our money comes from bespoke suits, Savile Row style, or it comes from academia, but it doesn't come from like real public work that we'd like to be doing, which is basically very difficult to pull off in America in 2021.
As Kolb just described, most members of this generation compromise between academia and practice. Here's Curtis Roth.
Most of the people I know are practicing, Most of the people I know, though, aren't making a living entirely off of practicing. So it's like living which is cobbled together between teaching and practicing. It's not like that it's a turn towards pure representation or purely speculative work or something like that. But I do think that it's something that it's a kind of trying to find a niche in a particular market and usually cobbling together a relationship between work that you're trying to do outside professionally and then, you know, teaching gigs, which require an enormous amount of specificity.
However, some saw this generation as chiefly academic, with few meaningful engagements with practice. While they expressed a deep desire to transition into building practice, they just didn't have the same skill set as professional architects. Here's Kyle Miller and Michael Young.
It's always peculiar how many of my friends think of themselves first as architects and secondly as academics. I think if you put it on a spreadsheet, how many hours they spend doing one of those things versus the other, or how much income is earned from one of those venues or the other, I suspect most of them are academics first and practicing architects second. And again, there's just no urgency to flip to reverse that role because of the stability and salary provided by these institutions and the freedom that we're afforded. I mean, it's such a luxurious position to the point where some of the more well-known architects in the U.S. have built very little. Built an identity and a profile through their student work and through their speculative work. Not their fault, it's just a symptom of the situation of the academic institutions. I know some of them now are desperately trying to make that transition into the slower, more tedious process of trying to build. I mentioned team earlier, and I can think of a few others, but yeah, because so many of us have the opportunity to teach almost immediately after school, like you almost don't ever become a product of the professional environment in a way that you would allow you to put pressure on yourself to operate slightly differently than from how a thesis student operates.
I didn't want to be an academic architect. I wanted to be an architect that was interesting for discursive reasons, but also interesting for the ways in which built work was happening. Now, the built work, we've done one building, so the built work hasn't really happened at the same rate. And we put most of our energy into teaching, into exhibiting, into experimenting, into writing about the things we're trying to experiment with. And that's meant quite a bit of energy has been pulled away from the practice. But because we were teaching, it allowed us to have this financial breathing room so that the practice could do what it wanted to do. It could do the experiments. It could take commissions that we thought were the right commissions. And it could also at the same time try to challenge our own ways in which we would think about our tools and our ideas as architects. Now, that sounds like an ideal world. And if you can make that last as long as you can make that last, then that's super exciting. But it does come to a certain moment where all of a sudden to actually have a firm that can put together buildings of significant complexities and scales and sizes, you need people. And you need people and systems and stability and a whole sort of mechanism. Like I look at my brother is an architect as well, and he's doing great work, but it's taken him this past 15 years when I've been building an academic practice, he has built a professional practice. And I've seen the kind of struggles and pain and work that takes, and it's hardcore. It is serious at every level, but it does not mess about with, you know, a lot of the questions we're talking about right now in terms of ideological positioning or theoretical debate or how we understand the discipline at large. It is worried with the nitty-gritty of the day.
Young touches on a key point, this desire to be an architect who is interesting for discursive reasons. It really isn't that this generation is unable to practice, but that they struggle to find ways to produce built work that is in conversation with other architects. As academics, this generation remains committed to producing architecture that is relevant in the academies. Here are Mira Henry, Christy Ballier, and McLean Clutter.
Building up a practice is a very hard one. And some of that work is work you can lecture about, and some of it's not work that you really can always lecture about. And so sometimes it intersects, the work that gets built intersects with the discursive project, and sometimes it sits alongside of it.
I do feel a responsibility to have some level of connecting our work to an academic discourse, because I think that that is how we can ensure that the work is in dialogue with others. I think I have no interest in having a practice which is only in dialogue with the general public and can't translate back. And in the same way, I think we are looking to evolve the work that's maybe a bit more academic can move in the other direction.
It also gets caught up in much bigger questions that have to do with professional practice and American society. Thinking about friends and colleagues who have tried to make that professional turn, one thing that they find, which is familiar from practice, like I've worked in a lot of practices, one thing that they find that's familiar is that for every 10 projects that you bring in, one goes forward. Nonetheless, you have to be able to provide the professional infrastructure for that whole thing all along. And especially in like service firms, that means that you do a lot of work that you might not be proud of all parts of, or you're really proud of something, but you let something else go. Those kinds of projects are hard for architectural academics.
While we heard earlier about the difficulty in pursuing practice while on tenure track, it follows that once a designer has secured tenure, their time and energy can be reoriented towards building. Perhaps for this generation, getting tenure will mean a full-blown turn towards practice and the reskilling required to pull it off. Here's Cyrus Penarroyo and Meredith Miller.
I think about team. The moment that they got tenure, I think that they made a decision to focus more on cultivating a building practice. And, you know, I think they've had slow success, but definitely success in that.
We are explicitly pursuing more and more building projects, and we're more and more saying no to the kinds of projects that maybe we've done in the past but are more academic, like, you know, exhibitions and these kinds of things, because we just have such limited time and it takes a lot of our focus and time and commitment to try to cultivate a building practice, and it's going very slowly. But I think there is something about the engaging with others and, you know, what people might see as the limitations of budget and site and clients' desires and so on. I think those are the things that we really enjoy working with and finding opportunity in those constraints.
We will continue this discussion in our next episode on practice and hear from this generation on their efforts to build, the specificity of our American context, the stumbling blocks they've found in working towards a robust practice, and their feeling that their niche within architecture as a cultural practice produced by disciplinary experts is shrinking. You have been listening to Attention, the audio journal for architecture, issue 8, talking about my generation. Interviews were conducted by Joseph Bedford between 2021 and 2022. The editing and production was by Tim Cox. Narration was written by Tim Cox. Thanks to the Graham Foundation for Advanced Studies in the Fine Arts for their generous support. And thank you for listening.